Welcome to the Obscure Pastor Podcast. I'm Drew Carpenter, your host on the podcast for all kinds of ministers and other followers of Jesus who work in relative obscurity. Today on the podcast, I'm talking with Erica Henry. Erica's passion and pastoral focus is providing Jesus-looking spiritual nurture and communal leadership in her neighborhood through peacemaking, partnership, and dialogue. After earning her Bachelor of Science degree in organizational leadership from Greenville University, Erica went on to pursue her Master of Arts in theology with the emphasis in biblical languages from Fuller Theological Seminary. As a church planner and pastor for 8 years, Erica's had the opportunity to walk alongside others as a student of their experiences. Over the years, God has been continually expanding her vision of his heart for Jesus-centered community and relationships, which led her and her husband Blake to Allentown, Pennsylvania in the spring of 2019 to found the Holy District. Erica and Blake enjoy reading, traveling, and taking their dogs Sam and Spock on neighborhood walks. Erica, I've met Sam and Spock. How are they doing these days?
Oh, they're doing so well. We just got a new air conditioning unit. So Sam, he's just this giant, like 130-pound dog. He's a great Pyrenees, and he's just soaking up all that cool air. We're enjoying it too, but they're awesome. Yeah.
Very cool. Well, I appreciate you coming on the Obscure Pastor Podcast. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your ministry that you're doing in Allentown?
Yeah. So like you just shared, I moved to Allentown with my husband and my two dogs about a year ago now, which is crazy to think. And really what we're doing is something called a pioneer plant, which means you kind of drop in somewhere where there's not anything going on necessarily as far as our denomination goes, brethren in Christ, and you see what you can do, see what you can find, see what kind of team God might draw. No building, no sister church, no mother church for people who are familiar with kind of church planting strategies. And so Blake and I landed in Allentown in May. And we have this vision, and I say we, I'm the founding pastor, but Blake's like my biggest fan and such a huge support. And so he's attending seminary right now full time, but he helps me with a lot of things. And what we were envisioning before we got here was how can we provide an expression of the Christian church, of the Christian faith, that can survive kind of the shaking and the changing of our culture as we move more into a post-Christian kind of philosophy and understanding in the United States? How can we look forward and not wait until it's too late and provide a kind of community for people who are spiritually curious but maybe have either de-churched or are unchurched but are interested in the person of Jesus and are longing for community and for a place to talk about the things that really matter? And so we moved to Pennsylvania, to Allentown, to do that. And it's interesting because right now, a year in, the gatherings that we're hosting are, they're virtual. Obviously, we're in the middle of this pandemic, and so we've not been able to gather physically. And so we live in Allentown, Pennsylvania. We're from Southern Illinois originally. We moved from Mesa, Arizona to Allentown. And so really what's going on right now is we're holding these virtual gatherings where we're trying to do, this kind of community that's open to all, where we can talk about things that matter, where dialogue is more central than maybe kind of hierarchical leadership and teaching. And really the people who are a part of our community right now are from all over the country. And so I'm excited for when the restrictions are lifted and we're able to kind of get back into the neighborhood more and be with others who are physically, you know, in proximity to us. But right now, the work that we're doing is with people all over the country. I didn't know if you knew that, Andrew.
I was kind of familiar with that. Do you not have anybody like, because we, Tim and I, my co-pastor and I, we came up and visited you guys this winter at some point. I don't remember when it was we saw you last, but You have neighbors that you've connected with. Are any of those neighbors a part of the cohort or the group that meets online?
Yeah, we do. We have several friends that we've connected with throughout our time here. One of the challenges, however, is we live in the poorest zip code of our city. And the majority of our friends and neighbors that we have gotten to know don't have the same level of access when it comes to technology, when it comes to internet access, when it comes to availability and time that some of us enjoy. And so honestly, during this time of pandemic, where we've had the ease and the privilege to put some energy toward gathering virtually, unfortunately, our neighbors have not had an easy time connecting in that way. And so it's a huge challenge being able to minister in that context as far as accessibility goes. It's something that our community is up against that maybe some other communities don't have to think about as much.
Right. Yeah. That definitely presents a challenge. And I think that's probably a bigger challenge just on so many other levels too, just aside from the internet. I mean, we just see that the way this virus is working in communities like yours and how difficult it is for people to kind of navigate all of that and get the health care that they need, or even know that they don't just have the flu, they have something else. And
yeah, I think, you know, what something like a pandemic does is it doesn't create new problems necessarily, but it actually reveals all these underlying problems that many of us are able to be ignorant of or not aware of. And then, of course, exacerbates those problems for those communities. They've always been there. They've always been affecting these communities. And now it's just becoming so increasingly clear, the inequity and how that limits flourishing for people who just don't have the same amount of access to things that others may.
Yeah. It's just tough, and it's heartbreaking, and it's, I'm glad you and Blake have taken on that calling to be there and be a part of that community and to live among people who definitely don't look like you guys and didn't have had some of the same experiences that you have, but you can still be brothers and sisters and kind of navigate all that together. And yeah, it's good.
Thank you. Yeah.
Well, tell me this. You came on the Obscure Pastor podcast. Do you consider yourself to be obscure?
You know, I don't know that I ever thought about myself in those terms necessarily, but whenever you pose that question, I'm like, oh yeah, definitely. I mean, who's Erica Henry? I am so grateful to have loved ones and community and friends and family who love me and care for me and know me and like me. However, I am not someone that would have any level of notoriety if that's what you're asking. So yeah, I think obscure would be a fair category for me.
All right. I know you, right?
Yes,
so,
yes.
I don't know. I don't know how that works exactly. It was an idea that popped in my head back in late 2019. I was like, huh, that's a good word. It's kind of fun to say. And so maybe
it'll
stick. But anyway.
It is. It's very catchy.
Yeah. So we're there. I'm definitely one of those obscure pastors. Obviously, there's not a million people following my podcast with folks, but I sure enjoy doing it and having people on, so it's cool. So what have been some of the challenges? I mean, you kind of talked about, you know, just talked about your neighborhood and where you guys are serving and what you're trying to do. What are some of the challenges that you were facing maybe pre-COVID and then COVID, and then what you think is going to be the challenge as we move out of this time, if we ever move out of this time of social distancing and whatnot?
Sure. Yeah. What a strange time. When I think about ministry challenges, we're actually in this, like when I say we, I mean, talking about Blake and myself and the Holy District team, the people who are involved in planting of this church here in Allentown. When I think about ministry challenges, I think, you know, the big one that I'm primarily concerned with is, like I said earlier, we we all recognize, I think, especially when it comes to the white evangelical American church in particular, there's an awareness that people are becoming less and less interested in attending church. That, you know, maybe 5 or 6 decades ago, there was an expectation on participation in some kind of religious gathering, and actually some level of privilege that came along with that to be someone who is not Christian or religious in some way made you suspicious. You know, kind of the word atheist was synonymous with, I don't know, Satan worshiper. I guess I should also preface, I come from Southern Illinois. So I come from the rural Midwest. And so that's particularly the perspective I'm speaking from. So I should be careful not to overgeneralize. But there, I think people think back on an America where you just go to church, you know, and everyone's a Christian and this is a Christian nation or whatever those ideas may be. And there's a growing sense and a growing awareness that that's not who we are anymore. That's not how our culture functions anymore. That's not the trajectory of our culture. And I think that has caused a lot of alarm for churches. But for me, it's caused a lot of curiosity. And it's really caused me to, you know, a question that I have and that I pray about, you know, I want to be a part of building and leading a church that my great, great grandkids can be a part of. I want to be a part of a church that actually has staying power in a culture that is not so tender toward Christianity or Christendom. And what does that look like? What does church look like whenever nominal Christianity is becoming less helpful to people and people are becoming more and more spiritual and curious rather than religious? And so that's kind of, for me, the ever-present challenge of what does the church look like? What will the church look like in 10 years or 20 years or 50 years? And I genuinely believe that there is a need for the church to be more nimble and more spacious, to be more curious. And when I say the church, I mean, I don't mean like a physical building where people go. I mean the community of believers who have given their allegiance to Christ, the way that we gather, the way that we align ourselves, the way that we do community, the way we engage in our neighborhoods. I think there needs to be some innovation and some creative ways for us to go about doing that. And so that's kind of the thing that's always on my mind. My husband and I helped plant a church with some family and friends in our hometown in Illinois when I was 19 years old. We did that for 5 years before I went away to seminary, where then we joined a staff at a mega church in Arizona. And there I led our small group ministry, our discipleship ministries, and our cares-oriented ministries. And through that whole time, that's always been my question of our world is changing. We all feel it. The way that we've been doing things isn't working. Most pastors that I talk to say the product of evangelical American Christianity, like the fruit that we're bearing, is not good fruit for the most part. So what are we going to do? How can we reimagine? How can we reimagine what it means to be a community of faith, and how can we invite others into that new vision? And so that's still the thing that I think about right now in COVID-19 and beyond. I think that question is just on the radar more for people right now because they have to think about it. You know, you have to think about how do we do this differently when you're not allowed to gather together in a building. And our model for the Holy District, we don't even have a building. Our model for the Holy District is that we want to, it's three parts. The first part is our gathering portion. And the idea is that we believe that God is everywhere at all times. We believe God's holiness and God's presence fills all things. And that there's no such thing as like a sacred special building that you have to go to be together with the community of Jesus or to encounter the presence of God. And so we kind of believe that wherever people want to gather and hang out is a place that we could go and actually, with some intentionality, create an opportunity to have dialogue around things that matter. For example, our last series that we just wrapped up in our gatherings is on being human. So we talked about what does it mean to be human, and are humans different than animals and other living things? And if so, how? And if not, why not? And what's an ideal human look like? And how could we achieve that? Or can we? And just wrestling through these ideas that really anyone from any perspective would be able to engage. And then the second part of the model, so that conversation can happen in a pub, in a cafe, in a park, wherever people would be comfortable hanging out and sitting and chatting and eating or drinking a cup of whatever. The invitation then from that gathering is that if you're interested in the Jesus way, that you can listen to our podcast. We have the Holy District podcast, where following the gathering, I, as the pastor of the Holy District, my whole job in that gathering is not to teach, but to listen to the dialogue. And as I listen to the dialogue and am trying to pay attention to where I see the Holy Spirit already at work within this community of people, to then provide a Jesus-centered teaching on whatever topic that we have that's responsive to what's on the hearts and minds of our community. So people are invited who attend the gathering or don't, if they're interested in thinking about and learning about a Jesus-centered perspective on whatever issue we're dialoguing around, then they can just tune into the podcast and, once again, listen to it wherever. You don't have to sit in a holy building to learn from Jesus or learn about Jesus. You can do it while you're giving your child a bath. You can do it while you're commuting to work or washing the dishes or going for a run, whatever that may be. And then the invitation from there is that if you are actually interested in learning how to follow Jesus, which is what we're committed to as the leaders and the people who are part of the team, then the invitation is into spiritual direction and discipleship that happens in the context of one-on-one and small group relationships. And so those three parts can happen anywhere. And right now, the challenge for us has been, well, we were imagining a church that doesn't happen in a church building, but can happen anywhere in the community. And then we were told, oh wait, but you can't go out into the community. Right. And so I was not prepared for that obstacle. I was prepared for some other obstacles, but not for that one, which is why we have been focusing our attention to virtual gatherings and trying to create that sense of a belonging community online during the season. And probably we'll continue to do that even after restrictions loosen and we see what our new reality is post COVID-19, which who knows even what that means or when we will get there or if we'll ever be post COVID-19. I'm not really sure.
Yeah. Well, and you've got, it's a very interesting model. And I say that it's very intriguing. And I think you are, yeah, definitely on the kind of pioneer cutting front edge of whatever the church is going to look like next. And I think the current reality that we're finding ourselves in as more traditional styles of church are, I think hopefully we're confronting those and figuring those things out so that we can do maybe a better job than we were doing before of actually making disciples.
Sure.
So that's kind of what I'm hoping will result, at least in my context, is that we'll figure out how to do the disciple making component a lot better than we're doing right now. And with that, you reach more people because you have more disciples that are actually following the way of Jesus. So
sure. Yeah.
You got there in the spring of last year. It seems like you've been here for a while, right? Because we've known each other since before you get right as you were getting here, I guess. And you've preached in our church two or three times now. What are some places that you get? I mean, obviously you guys have some difficult things that come your way. What are the things that you do to kind of get back to center whenever you feel like things are just not going well? Or if you, I don't know, maybe things are going great and you're like, this is my routine. This is what I'm always going to do to keep myself centered.
Yeah. Well, let's see here. You know, I think I just talked really broadly about just, I think, the general challenge I sense for the church in our current moment. But I think, you know, more specifically, the challenge that I face as a pastor in Allentown, having transplanted here, not knowing the community, into a community that has been economically, you know, underprivileged and is suffering in many ways. One of the challenges that I have is to remember and pay attention to all of the assets that are present. You know, I think something that's shifted so much in my understanding of the world, my theology over the last 8 or so years is my understanding of poverty and my understanding of the way that God sees the poor and the way that God sees people who are on the margins. And I learned that I had a really unhelpful misconception about what poverty is, and that poverty only had to do with material, a lack of material possessions or money or finances. But there are multiple kinds of poverty. And so my neighborhood may have material poverty, but my neighborhood is rich and relationships and community. In my neighborhood has so many strengths and assets. And one of the challenges of being here and being a white person in a predominantly non-white space and is that I'm learning to adjust and to understand and to enter into different cultures than what I grew up being accustomed to. I'm learning to unwrite and undo so many scripts that tell me what makes someone's, you know, approach or ideas valuable. And I have all of these theological beliefs about what makes someone valuable, and that every person is made in the image of God, and that every person is deserving of dignity, and that God is that God is able to speak and engage with every person. And, you know, we have this picture in the New Testament of the priesthood of all believers, that every person that is a part of the body of Christ is designed to and made to be a priest to one another. And so I love that. I love those ideas. And then you go from like my life where I was in predominantly white spaces, predominantly suburban spaces, predominantly middle class spaces, to our neighborhood. And I have all these theological ideas that then I actually have to live out in my relationships with my community. And there's been a lot of unlearning. And that, so I say that in answer to your question, because what I found is, as challenging as that's been, and it has been deeply inspiring to me. It has been deeply moving for me to encounter Christ in my neighbors and people who are used to being treated by the church oftentimes as projects and as people who need something and who need to be fixed, but to actually see Christ in my neighbors and to see that they are bringing probably more to the table when it comes to what it means to live in the kingdom of God and what it means to live as people of God. Thinking about the Beatitudes, when I see Christ in my neighbors, that is inspiring to me in the same way that it's healing for me. My neighborhood is witnessing to me and evangelizing me. And that's something that I just like to clarify for people, especially because we do live in a neighborhood that's economically challenged. I think sometimes the assumption is, oh, it's so good, you know, you're going there to help those people. And that actually is not really the intent. The intent is, you know, talk about obscure. Jesus teaches us that those that are greatest in the kingdom of heaven are the least in the kingdom of the world. Those who are first will be last. Those who are last will be first. And so if I really believe what Jesus taught, if I really believe what Jesus said about like the hierarchy of the kingdom, if you know, we can use that term, I am living amongst kings and queens. I am living amongst royalty. I'm living amongst the greatest in the kingdom of God, and they are teaching me. And that is so inspiring to me to keep that in mind. When you're not in proximity to people who, when you're someone who has material wealth and you're not in proximity to people who don't have material wealth, it becomes really easy to associate blessing and value and success with influence and being known and what you have and how much money you have and how much possessions you have and how much security you have. But whenever we look at the teachings of Jesus, that is not at all how Jesus thinks about success. And so that inspires me. But then at a really practical level, man, I have learned to develop a more contemplative spirituality over the last 6 or 8 years. I grew up in an environment where I certainly was taught to pray and read my Bible, but I was taught petitionary prayer, you know, basically. And I was taught, you know, how to talk to God about the things I was worried about and ask God for things. And then intercessory prayer, how to pray for other people, but not really taught how to listen to God. And over, as I have gone through various challenges in my life and ministry, particularly, I'm only 28. So I started in ministry when I was 19. I'm 28 now. So I've been doing it for a few years, but I'm young. You know, I'm a young woman. I've been young the whole time that I'm doing this. And man, there have been a lot of obstacles that I have run into just because of those two things in combination. And if there is not an opportunity to hear from God about who you are and how He's called you to be in the world and to whom He has called you, then I really don't know if I would still be in the game, because it's very, very difficult. It's very difficult to be in ministry. It's difficult to be a woman in ministry. It's difficult to be a young woman in ministry. And so I have been very grateful through mentors and through other pastors and through my seminary education to learn how to spend time in prayer, listening to God, being being present with God, just seeking to be with Jesus in my prayer time. And some of the most significant moments that I've experienced, transformative moments I've experienced in my life that have really inspired me and given me, I mean, like 5 minutes, which have given me a year's worth of resolve, have come in moments of contemplative prayer. Hmm. Yeah.
Very cool. I kind of think of I was a missions pastor for a while, and I took kids on mission trips and mission outing stuff, but I also did that for adults. And a couple of the things that I always try to come back to is kind of the helping hurts model of, you know, Jesus is already in that neighborhood.
Yes.
Right. The light's already there. And the other thing was like one of the gospels where they come to Jesus because they're like, the people need some bread. We can't take care of these people because they need to go get food. And he's like,
right.
He asked Andrew, well, what do you have? Or Andrew is the one that comes up and says, well, we have this. And that was Jesus' answer, was like, not what are you missing or what are you lacking? He's right. Like, well, what do you got? Mm. And then he worked with it. And so yeah. I try to help my folks that were doing mission work to see that these people have things to offer. What are we going to do to help them see that in themselves? Because they're oftentimes they don't see that in themselves. And so part of our job was just pointing it out to them and say, look, this is, you do this great, you know? So
right,
affirming right. that in people. And I think you're probably in a very similar situation. You have a lot of great people around you. It's just maybe nobody's ever said, hey, you're awesome. And
yeah.
people need that just from each other. But it's good to have an outside source that could say, hey, no, this is what you do, right? And we all need that. We all need somebody to point out things about us that we don't necessarily recognize, good and bad.
Absolutely. You know, yeah. We were walking our dogs the other day. It's one of the primary ways that we love our neighbors is just being out in the neighborhood. And like I said, we have this giant 130-pound dog that's like fluffy white, so cute. And I mean, people stop their cars when we're walking down the street, because they just love him. They want to stare at him. And then we have another little Boston Terrier French Bulldog mix who's very cute, but definitely lives in the shadow of our other dog. But we just, you know, we walk and we, you know, we say hi to our neighbors and we strike up conversation where we can. And Sam is one of the greatest missionaries, I think, because he opens up a lot of conversational doors for us. And a couple weeks ago, we're COVID mask walking around, but we walked, there's a bar that's pretty close to where we live in our neighborhood. And there's always a couple people sitting out in front of the bar. And whenever we walk by, we'll stop and chat and say hi, and they want to pet our dogs. And we always do that. And there's just something about, this is so powerful. There's something about looking someone in the eye when they talk to you. There's something about asking to hear more when they're sharing a story with you. There's something about just leaning into them and their story. And this is something that I have experienced from my family, from, like I said, friends and loved ones, my community, people showing interest in me and just generally in the way they look at me and approach me and talk to me, making me feel as if I matter and I'm important to them, at least in that moment. And what I've seen in just a couple people we see every single time that we walk by is there's just like this blossoming. Like you see them set up a little straighter. You see some light come into their eyes. You see the animation. They feel that sense of like, oh, this person cares. This person values me. And we had a friend who we met in a trance meeting, and she was homeless. She was on drugs at the time, and she was working the streets as a prostitute. And we had a really amazing opportunity to get to know her. She came to our house for dinner, and we just got to hear about her life and learn from her. And eventually she ended up in jail because she was actually, she had broken her probation. And so she ended up in jail. And so we would go to visit her. And while she was in jail, she's such a charismatic person. She's got a lot of leadership, and people look to her for advice. And she grew up on the streets, and she's super, super street smart and just understands kind of the way the world works in our neighborhood. And so lots of people know her and got to know her. And before long, we would encounter people on the street as Blake and I were walking our dogs, and they would say, "Hey, are you Blake and Erica?" And we're like, "Yeah." We know who they were. We'd never seen them before. And it was people that our friend in jail had met, and they had been released from jail, but she had talked to them about us. And they remembered us because they'd seen us, and they told us, we're like, "Oh yeah, I'm sorry. I don't remember you. Do I know you? We had a conversation. You don't really know me, but I've seen you walking by before. And every time we walk by, like the women who are working on that street, sex work and things like that, they're like, you're the only people who actually smile at us. You're the only people who actually look at us. You're the only people that say hi to us. You're the only people that don't make us feel like you wish we were gone." And for us, for me, months and months of just kind of being in the neighborhood and feeling pretty worthless, honestly, there's really big issues that we don't really know how to engage fully. And just wondering, like, praying, "God, what do we do? How are you sending us? How are you calling us to be good news to our neighbors? How are you calling us to demonstrate your kingdom in our neighborhood?" And wondering just like, what does that look like? And then to have these encounters where people are saying, "You saw me when no one else sees me," how that small token of just looking someone in the eye and smiling at them and caring about them when they speak, what that speaks. And I think that's really powerful.
Awesome. Thanks for sharing that. Kind of as we get a little closer to wrapping things up, have a couple of more light questions that we ask everybody. I want to know who your favorite musical artist is.
I have so many different musicians that I love, but I don't have a favorite.
Who are you listening to today? Have you listened to anybody today?
Oh yeah. So today I've been listening to The Porter's Gate.
Okay.
And yeah. So I would recommend anybody and everybody listen to The Porter's Gate. But I will say, my dad raised me on like 90s singer-songwriter angry women. Not angry women, but like passionate women. So I love like Jewel and Alanis Morissette and Paula Cole, and singer-songwriters in general I'm a fan of. So any given day, I'm probably listening to one of those gals.
Well, tell me something about you that not very many people know.
Oh, something about me. Oh, when I was 17 years old, my friend Cassie, she received a birthday gift from one of our teachers who was a skydiving instructor to go skydiving for free, and she could invite one friend, and she invited me. So yeah, I've been skydiving. I don't know if you know that, but that's one of my favorite least known facts about me.
Cool. Were you 17 when you did it?
I was. Yeah, I was 17.
Wow. I thought you had to be 18 even to do that stuff, but oh.
Maybe I think my mom might have had to, my mom and my stepdad came and watched, and so they may have like signed off on it. But yeah, that was awesome. I did what's called a static line jump. So most people, when you go skydiving the first time, you'll do a tandem jump where there's someone, you're attached to someone, and you both jump at the same time from like 10,000 feet.
Yeah.
But if you want to get your skydiving license, you have to do so many jumps. And so you start with what's called a static line. And all that means is, you know, they pack your pack and then they hook a line to it so that you don't pull your chute. You free fall for as long as the line is. And then when the line pulls tight, it pulls your chute for you.
Oh, okay.
So it's like the first step of like teaching yourself how to skydive. So that's what I did. And so legitimately the way that it worked was we're in this little plane and they get to the proper altitude, and I was the first one to jump for whatever reason. I think I like weighed a little bit more than my friend, or the other way around. I don't know. It was a windy day and we had to wait for hours to actually go in the sky because it was so windy that they were concerned that we would not come down in the right place. And so, so I was first, and you sit, there's no door on the side of the plane. You sit and you swing your legs out over the side. And then, you know, like the wing, how there's a crossbar that attaches or supports the wing to the body of the plane. I'm probably using all the wrong words. I'm not technically savvy about airplanes, but that bar that holds it up, you put your hands on the bar and then the pilot says, get out. And so you drop your legs out and now you're just literally hanging by your hands from the wing of the plane. And there was a little X made with like tape or paint or something on the bottom of the wing. So they say, get out, and you get all the way out, and then they say, look up. And when you look up, you see the X, and then you let go of your hands. So you fall in kind of like an X shape. And I just did it. I mean, at that point, you're like, I guess
I'm out here.
What I'm doing. I'm just going to jump out of a plane. And so it's just like, it was crazy. It was amazing. And got down. They had a walkie-talkie clip to like your chest or whatever, and someone guiding you like toggle left, toggle right. So you pull your little handles on your right and left side, and they like guide you back to the landing area. And oh my gosh, it was amazing. I'd do it again right now if I could.
Well, Erica, thanks for coming on today. How do people find you if you want to be found? What's the best way to connect with you?
Yeah. So if you are interested in like the Holy District, you can check out our website, holydistrict.org. That has our contact information, social media. You can find us on social media at Rediscover Sacred. Rediscover Sacred is our handle, because that's part of our vision, is rediscovering the sacred in everyday spaces. And then I think on like social media, on Instagram and Facebook, me personally, I think it's just like at Erica Jane Henry. But my name, Erica, is spelled weird. It's E-R-I-C-K-A. So that would be something to be on the lookout for. But yeah, that's how you can find out more about what we're doing here.
Well, I think I have most of those links, and I'll put them in the liner notes on the podcast, whatever those are called. I don't know. It'll go in there and people can link to find you, all those spaces. Well, awesome. Do you have anything else you'd like to close out the show by saying or doing?
Oh, I don't think so. I'm just really grateful for you having me on, Andrew. It's a good time talking with you.
It's always great to talk to you, Erica. Thanks for doing this. You have a great rest of your week.
You too.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Obscure Pastor Podcast. If you like the podcast, share it with a friend. Subscribe today and sign up at obscurepastor.com for my brief weekly e-letter. It's a dose of encouragement and inspiration. You can also find me on Twitter and Instagram at Drew Carpenter. So let's be friends.